Well, that's all. So let's go straight into a session. But merging the mood or the ambience of the morning sessions with the afternoon. So as you venture into the practice, focusing on the theme, of course, of attention, that you, when you go into the practice, whatever method you choose of the shamatha that you're really attending, that is tending to, in the spirit of looking after, watching over, and caring for yourself. So, keep that mood, and things will go very smoothly. Let's do that. Let's have one quiet session. Anna, so Anna, the microphone is yours. You're on.
Thank you very much. Sure. Actually, the question that I was going to ask this morning is not relevant anymore. But there is one that I have written for you, and I'll ask that if you don't mind.
That's fine, sure.
I'll rephrase it because I think my bit of writing is not very clear.
Uh-huh.
It's connected with dreams, lucid dreams, and it has occurred to me that different people may have a different waking up bits. For instance, you mentioned...
I missed that. Different people have different waking up?
You know, we use, according to your book, and you yourself have mentioned many times, for instance, if you to check if you are awake in a dream, pull your nose.
Yeah.
And other things.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't work for me, pulling the nose.
Uh-huh.
I've had a couple of modest lucid dreams, and it doesn't work.
And you pulled your nose, and it stayed firm?
No. And I'm just wondering...
I'm just trying to understand. Yeah. You were in a lucid dream?
Yeah.
And you pulled your nose, and it stayed the same?
The same.
And you jumped straight up, and you just...
No, I don't jump straight up. I use other ways.
Okay, whatever works.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering if what we are taught... And what we learn, because of the mind, after all, is very, you know, plastic.
Yeah.
Whether what we see as relevant in the lucid dream changes according to our mind frame, the observer will change the, you know, what goes around. For instance, I know if I say to myself that I am very thin, very energy, then I can go through very peacefully. So it's no point pinching me because I wouldn't be able to pinch myself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, pinching is really one of the worst methods. It hardly ever works. I don't know if it ever does work. Pinching, am I dreaming or not? You pinch yourself in the dream, and normally it will just pinch right back. If you've already created yourself more like a ghost, then there won't be anything to pinch.
That's right, yeah. Okay, so this is really what I wanted to know, whether you want to enlarge or not. I don't know.
But whether I want to, I don't understand.
If you want to expand on this, the observer can change, what is the emptiness in the mind?
How the observer changes the emptiness of the mind?
Not the enlightenment emptiness, but the illusionary.
Do you mean simply how the observer can change the dream?
How it appears in the first place. Because,
how the dream appears in the first place?
Well, let me just, again, give another example.
Okay.
I may have a simple dream, right?
Yeah.
Like I wake up in a kitchen and I want to drink water and I go to the sink and so on. And, for instance, once again, I know that if I think I'm very thin, very like that,
ethereal.
I won't be able to pick up.
Yeah, you've become a ghost.
The glass, you see.
Yeah.
I have to change, and
That's
I have
right.
to think of myself as solid. But there is something else. Say I've been to a horror film.
You've been to a?
Horror.
Horror film?
You know, a nightmare film. Very strong impact.
Right.
At night, I dream I am in that landscape.
Right.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's happened to me a few times. I don't look at horror films now. I go into a consensual landscape. Created by, something else. And then I don't find it's so easy to change if I want to change something.
Uh-huh.
I must really be frightened to change, say something following me or that. Otherwise, can't change it.
Mm-hmm. And there was a question there someplace.
Yes, and I said...
Okay, I'll imagine that I've heard a question and I'll pretend that I'm answering the question that I've imagined you said. I'm going to go straight to dream yoga because I think it's much deeper than, it's just more profound than just the secular methods. I think secular methods are fantastic and they're very accessible and that really makes a very great strength. But the dream yoga has been around for 1,000 years and it has great depth to it. And so in that context, now to Buddhist dream yoga practice, the reason for entering into the first major phase of exploration in dream reality, once you become lucid and you've kind of stabilized that lucidity, and what that means is that you're maintaining a continuity of the dream so it doesn't fade out, and you're also maintaining a continuity of your awareness that it is a dream. So those two are two independent variables, because you could maintain lucidity and lose the dream, in which case then you would go into lucid, dreamless sleep, or you could maintain the dream but lose lucidity and forget that you're dreaming and then just be caught once again in a non-lucid dream, right? But with some kind of support from your shamatha practice, and that is training the mind and relaxation so you don't become lucid and then suddenly wake up because you're so excited, and so keep more relaxed, at ease. Oh, yeah, another lucid dream. Yeah, like that. And so relaxed and then stable, and then keep a clear dream that has a lot of good detail. Then once you have that, then the next major phase in classic dream yoga is the phase of emanation and transformation, or transformation and emanation, it's called. And here, you're using your power. It's so much like the placebo effect, so much like the placebo effect that I discussed when I was responding to a question from Bruce. And that is, you take a pill and you believe that this will make your arthritis be much less painful. And you believe that, and you respect the person that gave it to you. You think, oh, this person really knows, and you expect it will be, believe it will be, hope it will be, and you take the tablet, which turns out to be sugar, and it does just what you hoped it would do. All right, and why? Because of that expectation, that belief, and so forth. So in a similar fashion, you can apply, because this is the power of the mind, and largely untapped, you know, to a very large extent, untapped. But now we can really tap it in a lucid dream. And that is, in the lucid dream, simply arouse an expectation. So I'll give an example. Let's say you would like to meet Albert Einstein. I would love to have met him myself, because I think he was a very interesting man and very benevolent man in many respects. And so let's say you're in the dream and say, I would really like to meet Albert Einstein. Probably won't get the real one, but I'd like to see a good imitation, you know, created by my mind. So how do you do that? You're wandering around in a city and I'd like to meet Albert Einstein. Well, you simply generate the thought, I'm sure he's here somewhere. In fact, I'm quite sure he lives right around the street, around this corner, I believe three doors on the right. That, I think that's where he lives. Let's go check. And lo and behold, you go around the corner. This happens very often. And there's a house that says, Albert Einstein lives here. And then you knock on the door, and there he is. Goofy looking, the hair all crazy looking, and the mustache, and looking those very sweet eyes of his. And he says, hello, a nice German accent. You know, or if you speak German, then of course, then he really speaks in German. Otherwise, he just pretends. You know? And then you can have a conversation with him. Now, he will know about as much mathematics and physics as you do, but he'll give it in such a nicer way. And so you can conjure up people in that way, just by the power of expectation. Or, as you found, by turning your body into more an ethereal body, a less substantial body, you can walk right through walls. You can, but just by expecting, looking at a body of water, you can simply, I'm sure I can walk on this. I'm sure, why not? And then, you know, have that confidence, and then you can, you know. And so this is how you're engaging with the environment, but you can also transform things. And this is by the power of imagination, expectation, that confidence. This here are just two cell phones on the floor here. I'd like to see a bunch of cell phones. And suddenly they start going bloop, 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 like little cells bifurcating. And the floor is filled with cell phones. So you can make one, many, many, one, and so forth. The small, the big, the small. And so why do this? Because it's not just a circus trick. It's not to show how powerful and macho you are, to build up your ego. That would be silly, totally nonsensical in the Buddhist context. But rather, as I mentioned before, it's like a toddler, like a little child, learning about the environment by touching, putting into the mouth, and so forth, by interaction. A cat comes over and pulls on its tail and see what happens. And the cat goes, meow. And so, oh, that's what happens, you know? And so not just by thinking about it or meditating on it, but by active interaction, then you learn about the nature of dream reality and how plastic, how malleable it is, how amenable it is to change with your imagination, expectation, and so forth. And in that, and of course, you can change yourself too. You can be, as you've already discovered, you can be a shape shifter. You can be a nice-looking Italian woman, or then you can turn into a nice-looking Italian dog, you know, or anything you like. Or there was one woman, quite remarkable woman, tell a short story. She was at a workshop that Stephen LaBerge and I were leading many years ago at Stanford University, and she was crippled. She was in a wheelchair. But not only that, but she was in a lot of physical pain. I think her back, but had chronic pain. So she was overweight, she was in a wheelchair, and she had chronic pain. So it was not pleasant at all being in her body. But probably in part because of her physical distress, she became a very adept lucid dreamer. She was really accomplished. She could have a lucid dream pretty much whenever she wanted to. So she reported one night, that is, she dreamt during the night, of course, and then we would have in the workshop people report on their dreams. And she reported one, I think it was during the nighttime, where she transformed herself into a phonograph record, you know, and then turned on the player and said, like that, you know. And then she kind of got bored with that. I can easily imagine how one would get bored. And then she changed herself. She transformed right from a phonograph record to a butterfly and then flew out the window, you know. And so seeing this total plasticity of your own presence, of course you can also disappear, just be an invisible presence, transforming the environment in this way by causal interaction with the dream, your mind engaging with the reality of the dream, then you see from your own experience that there is nothing there in the dream, subjective or objective, that exists by its own inherent nature, that it's really there and resistant to the shifts by what we now call in Buddhism conceptual designation, that there's nothing there that's independent of conceptual designation and is resistant no matter how you want to modify it with your mind. Well, you can. And so you can really modify everything. And in that way, through practice, you can, in that little microcosm of your lucid dream, you can gain a realization of emptiness. So it's a little emptiness, but then as I mentioned before, especially if one has kind of the supercharge of having achieved shamatha, and then goes on to there and realizes the little emptiness within the dream, and then comes back in the waking state, and then probes into the emptiness of your own mind, especially empowered with shamatha, and then from that starts to realize the emptiness of external phenomena, then in between dreams, in the classic teachings, I'm sure you've heard them at Lama Tsongkhapa Institute, that in between sessions, while you're meditating on emptiness during sessions, in between sessions, you then really view all phenomena as being dreamlike. Remember that, yeah? And so dreamlike, well, now that you've really fathomed the nature of the dream, not just non-lucid dreams, you've really fathomed the nature of dreams, then in between sessions during the waking state, you can much more readily apply your insights into emptiness with respect to your own mind and all these phenomena here, and then really see now to what extent is waking reality really dreamlike. So that's a direct avenue to Vipassana during the daytime. Okay? So in a couple of years, if we continue the sequence that I've started here, then we'll have an 8-week retreat that will always have shamatha as the basis, just to make the mind supple and malleable, serviceable. But then we'll have a whole 8 weeks for nighttime practice of dream yoga and daytime practice of really investigating nature of emptiness, especially with respect to mind, following Mahamudra, Dzogchen, and so forth. So that's a plan a couple of years down the road, if I'm still alive. Okay. Thank you. Okay, good. We'll go over to James and then go over to the left side.
I'd just like to...
follow up.
Extend this topic a little bit.
Yeah.
So, as you've said a lot, one can only truly achieve access to the first jhana on a mental object.
That is a common consensus.
Common consensus. So, as we know, there's nothing but mental objects in dreams.
Say again?
There are nothing but mental objects within dreams.
That is correct.
So
yeah, they're replicas of visual form and auditory tactile and so forth, but they are mental replicas.
So in principle, it should be possible to actually keep our practice alive at night, maybe by generating some sort of, I don't know, a gem or, I mean, anything really, and just like maybe keep it going. You know, you know, it's going to be for like 15 minutes at a time, probably. But
sure, a single dream, according to Stephen LeBert, and he has his own research, but of course he did his PhD in dream research, or sleep research. As I recall, I think the longest dreams take about 90 minutes, one single continuous narrative. So that's a pretty good session. Yeah.
So you could actually, you know, you can actually keep your practice going at night.
Yeah, you really can. I remember when I did my first kind of longish shamatha retreat under His Holiness Dalai Lama's guidance in 1980. The practice I was given was in the context of state regeneration practice, so big time visualization, and I was doing, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 hours a day, but lots of visualization. It was all couched within a sadhana, and then I'd fall asleep at night, and he told me to do a certain number of sessions and do the sadhana a certain number of times, so it was had a certain structure to it, right? And I would find at night sometimes I would start doing the sadhana while I was dreaming, the same sadhana, the same practice while dreaming, and then I would ask myself, does this count? I wasn't quite sure one way or another. But certainly the habits we develop, you know, for better or worse, it always has that balance. The habits we develop for better or worse during the daytime, including seeing horror films, are very likely sooner or later to slip over into the dream state. And that's why Stephen LeBert so cunningly, he and his colleagues, so cunningly encourage us to develop the habit during the waking state to be looking for dream signs, just generally, whatever your dream signs are, keep your eyes open for them and look for anomalies, anything that's just out of the ordinary, and then adopt this critical, reflective attitude, really asking yourself, might I be dreaming? Even if you're quite sure you're not because everything's so vivid and so precise and detailed and so forth, no guarantee you're not dreaming. And so, and then performing some state check. So I learned about the pulling in the nose only recently, but it doesn't seem to work for the Italians. I think it's because of the Pinocchio syndrome, you know. But it works for a lot of people. And then jumping straight up, that worked for everybody except for one, who I think she's probably listening sooner or later, one neuroscientist I know. She's a scientist, and she jumped up in her dreams. She came crashing right down. Newton got even into her dreams, you know, the laws of gravity. But for most people, you float or you drift down one way or another. The reading test, that's a really good one. To have the script like, you know, a full long sentence, come back the same sentence 2 or 3 times. I haven't heard of that. So if you have some reading matter within hand's reach in a dream, read it, take it out, read it again. Almost certainly, 85% chance it'll be different the second time. Take it out again, 92% chance it's going to be different if you're dreaming. So those are good tests there. But yes, overall, if one has, and some people are, just again, it's just like mathematics, music, language, art. People have gifts, right? And some people are gifted in lucid dreaming. They just find it easy. They slip right into it. Probably had it as a natural ability as children. And so for such people, since you already have momentum there, right, then you may as well use it. In which case, you can use that to the dream state for a wide variety of meditations. The four immeasurables, shamatha, vipassana meditation, stage regeneration. You can imagine going to a pure realm, you know, and receiving teachings of the Buddha. And the more pure your mind becomes, then the purer the teachers will appear in your dream. So it can be, you know, a really major platform for very deep practice. And one final boon of that, I'll give two, is that overall, generally speaking, I don't think I've mentioned this actually, that in terms of just generally Buddhist psychology, and I believe it's the same in Hinduism, I'm not quite sure, but in Buddhism psychology, there's said to be coarse level of consciousness, subtle, and then very subtle. So you've heard this before. But in that subtle, they will include, in that general domain, not equivalent to substrate consciousness, but the more general category of subtle mind, dreaming. So they say between waking consciousness, here's it is, in the context of sleeping, awaking and sleeping, there's waking consciousness, there's dreaming consciousness, and there's deep sleep consciousness. So it's not the same as substrate and rikpa. Just that, waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, dreamless sleep. That goes from coarse, medium to subtle. Coarse, subtle, and subtler. And the subtler your mind, the more powerful it is. So if you can do the same practice in a dream with that subtle consciousness that has more efficacy than doing it with a cruder, more a cruder consciousness during the waking state. So in that regard, it can be a very high potential. And then all the more so if you can meditate in deep dreamless sleep, then that also can be very potent. Go ahead.
Could you also achieve access to the first jhana while dreaming?
I don't know why not. Sure. I mean, that's the other point I was going to make, and that is when you're dreaming, you're already in quasi-samadhi because your five physical senses have already imploded. If you're doing that during the waking state, you have to be up on stage 7, 8, or 9 for that, you know, before that really starts happening big time. And there you are. You can just get it by falling asleep, and already you're into quasi-samadhi, but you're samadhi in delusion if you're in a non-lucid dream because you're getting everything wrong. But if you can get everything fundamentally right, you're recognizing the dream as the dream, then there you are. You're not pestered by your body, your knees, your back, and so forth. You don't hear sounds and all of that. And so you're already kind of in your own little meditation hut of your domain of the mind. So sure, if you, it's possible in principle. No reason not. Good.
Can I make a question?
Yes, you may. I never choose anybody in the middle. So you position yourself right on the corpus callosum, I think it's called. Go ahead.
So about some obstacles I find in the...
Gosa?
Some obstacles I find in the practice...
Obstacles.
In the practice of dream yoga.
Yoga?
Dream yoga.
Okay.
One of the things is that when I'm falling asleep, I'm practicing awareness of awareness or mm-hmm. settling the mind.
Yeah.
And I start feeling that I am entering the dream state consciously.
Mm-hmm.
I start feeling my body paralyzed.
Yes.
And I know I'm going to go into lucidly.
Good.
But it feels bad. It feels uncomfortable, and
yeah.
I feel fear. It's not a pleasant experience.
Quite.
So there is some resistance of going into.
Yeah.
And then other times, while I'm already in the dream,
mm-hmm.
and I realize I'm lucid, I'm enjoying the dream or I'm having a good experience within a lucid dream.
Mm-hmm.
But then suddenly I listen to a noise that comes from kind of outside of the dream.
From your physical
environment.
From the physical environment. Yeah.
But in the dream, this makes me have a false awakening. First.
A false awakening, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I awaken my room, mm-hmm. but I realize I'm dreaming.
Understood.
Still. And this noise takes a weird form. Like I feel, while I was here in the retreat, I have once, for example, in the house where I was staying, that the dogs were making some noise, but in my dream, I was interpreting it like, someone was trying to go inside my room, forcing the door.
Uh-huh.
And I have like two choices, to continue in the dream
mm-hmm.
or force myself to wake up and see if it was something like an emergency.
Right.
And other time also happened that in that time I forced myself to wake up,
mm-hmm.
but my, on the other hand I say, I'm already lucid and I'm going to lose this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I wake up and I found it's something like the dogs just making noise.
Yeah.
And another occasion, someone
That's a lot.
Yeah. Well.
You can continue, but I need to. I'm trying to remember everything you said.
Okay. So how do I deal with this?
I'm getting to that. So what you're experiencing, and I think as you know, is called sleep paralysis, right? And Stephen LeBerge, I've heard him refer to this many, many times. And he's very keen, like Paul Ekman, he's very keen on drawing in evolution, a theory of evolution, to try to explain, you know, as many things as possible in terms of how our minds operate and the relationship of mind and body. A lot of it's very smart. And he's commented that this is very biologically, or from an evolutionary perspective, very adaptive, that when we are dreaming, the body does get paralyzed. All of the major limbs, your legs and your arms, get paralyzed. As you know, your eyes don't get paralyzed. You can move your eyes. But the big muscles of the limbs, they get paralyzed, and for very good reason. And so, I'll just explain really quickly. If you're dreaming, and you're dreaming that you're, fighting with a gorilla, and you're going, like that, and then your arms actually should move in the same way, that could really damage your relationship. with anybody who might be in the bed with you, you know, hospital, you know, repeatedly. And so, but also if you're up in a tree, then you fall out of a tree as you're banging against a tree and fall down and you die. So people who didn't get paralyzed, they fell out of the trees and so forth. But what happened to you? So without belaboring that point, it is unpleasant. I had the experience myself, and it can be kind of creepy. And also, in my experience, it was like being buried under earth, like you can't move. And that's like, what's wrong? But if you go to bed with this very clear sense, really 100% certainty, that this is normal and healthy, this is a good thing, that your body is paralyzed when you're dreaming, we need it for all these biological reasons and so forth, then if you find yourself in that limbo between kind of in the dream but still experiencing your body, when you were describing it, the image that came to my mind is a person who's on a dock, has one leg on a dock but wants to board a boat that will go off maybe to an island someplace, and so has one foot on the dock and the other foot on the boat, and then the boat starts to take off. That could be quite uncomfortable because you're not really here nor there. And so, yes, it's uncomfortable. And then how can you get out of that discomfort? Well, first of all, just having that total intellectual certainty with your wisdom mind. This is not bad. There is nothing to fear here. This is exactly what should happen to the body when you're going to the dream state. So in other words, there's just no ground for fear. Recognize this is a groundless fear, just knowing that, okay? But then, and knowing that, that kind of loosens things up a little bit. But then, now that you're already halfway there, then, as I'm right now focusing entirely on you and not even on Sally or Meek or Miles, but really focusing single-pointedly on you, and because I'm choosing to, and everybody else goes out of focus, similarly, single-pointedly focus on the dream. Use your power, the power to focus your attention and focus it entirely in the mental realm, disengage it entirely from the sensations of being paralyzed. Say, whatever, not my business, I'm not interested right now, just as if you were practicing subtly in the mind, or awareness of awareness. So use a bit of muscle, just to focus directly, single-pointedly on the dream, and in so doing, there won't be enough of your awareness left over to be aware of the paralysis of your body, and then you'll move entirely into the dream. You'll get onto the boat and then go on to dreamland, okay? But it calls for real concentration, taking the reins in your own hand and saying, I'm not going to be in both worlds. It's not comfortable. I can either be back in my body, the body will unparalyze very quickly, and that's okay, but then there you are. Or I can be over there, but I just don't want to hang out here. And then you just forcefully focus single-pointedly on the dream. Okay? So that was the first part. The second part.
About being in a false awakening and choosing to wake up because it might really be an emergency.
Yeah, I understood. I remember. Here it's very important, both for meditation as well as nighttime meditation and dream yoga. It's very important, if at all possible, that you place yourself in an environment where you know, again, with your mind, with your intelligence, you know this is safe. This is safe. In this place, if your windows are locked at night, okay, and the doors, man, they're solid. I think we've all seen the doors. They are solid doors, and the lock is a lock. And we have guards here, so overall, if your windows are locked, got that solid door, then there's no rational reason, there's no good reason to fear anything in this place. And you can find other environments where you say, look, beyond all reasonable doubt, could it happen that a meteor will land on my room and, you know, crush me? Well, yeah, but I'm not going to worry about it. Not now, anyway. You know? And so having that certainty, if you can go to bed with that certainty, that whatever sounds I hear in the dream, I'm in a safe place because I went to bed in a safe place. That's where I'm dreaming, in a safe place. So if I hear sounds of dogs be interpreted as somebody trying to break into the room, not in this place, maybe other places. But having that confidence, then you can release it. But if you don't have the confidence, then your survival instinct's going to come out, and then you'll want to wake yourself up and see, is anybody really trying to break into my room?
Well, what happened to me is I was here, and it was a safe environment. But Rosario was knocking on the door and screaming, Alma, Alma, and I thought it was an emergency in my dream.
Yeah.
So what about that?
Well, she was trying to break into your room. What can you do? You have to protect yourself.
But in my dream,
he's really tough,
I think
Mexican redhead.
She's
you have to
having
look out
a
for.
Problem. She's having an emergency. I should wake up and
that you should,
her.
Yeah.
Something
if like there can be unexpected things, that she wasn't going to harm you, but it could be an emergency. Somebody here could have a heart attack. They could have, you know, emergency happen. And she might have been the one to discover. It could happen. And for whatever reason, she wants to contact you. So it can happen. So this is, it's kind of like the situation with nyam, all right? If you think it might be something that's not a nyam, that it's a medical condition, if you're even concerned maybe it is, then you should check it. So you have to stop your meditation, go off to the hospital, check it, and maybe you'll be really happy. One student, I think you maybe know him, I'll keep him anonymous, but he was in a very strict retreat in Mexico, out in Baja, and he started developing this severe pain, and you know, he knows a lot about nyam, but it got pretty severe, so he thought maybe he should check with the doctor, you know, just play it safe. He was having appendicitis. That was a really good time to break his retreat. He did, got it treated, back into retreat now. So that's unexpected, but it can happen. But you don't say, well, I'm too tough for this. No, I'll just assume it's not a nyam. No, he was smart. He used his good practical intelligence, common sense, treated it, healed, and now he's back in retreat again. So whether it's a nyam, that something that might be a nyam but turned out not to be, absolutely, he could have died, or somebody who really, you know, the house is on fire, the mind center is on fire. Well, that could happen too. It's possible. So then you say, okay, it could be a nyam that is within my dream, but if there's any serious doubt, then go ahead and wake yourself up. Okay? Okay. Good. Oh, yeah. Got plenty of time. Anything on the right hemisphere? Everything over here? We'll go over to Regina. Say again? We haven't gone left yet. You're in the center. Off to the left and then over to the right. Anything on the left? Thank you. Anything on the left? Okay, after Regina. You have time after Regina. Go ahead, Regina.
Déjà vu.
Déjà vu, yeah.
You keep having déjà vu. What is that?
It's having déjà vu over and over and over again.
Not over and over and over, but many times, you know, you are in a place and you've been there, you know what people are going to say.
Call that a dream sign. Call that a dream sign. That should be a great big indicator. Oh, this has to be a dream, because I've been here like Groundhog Day. I've been here before. Like the movie,
but Groundhog Day. Not in a dream. I'm
in the waking state.
In the waking state.
How did you know? Did you do a state check?
Because sometimes you are talking.
I'm talking? Oh, I'm talking. That's a real odd one. Alan's talking. This must be a dream. I'm just... Even the dream, yeah.
I'm supposed to be in a waking state, so
as far
like
as you know,
sometimes
yeah.
It happens to me quite often.
Uh-huh.
That I know, you know, like I've been here, I've seen this, I've heard this, mm-hmm. And
I'll give you one hypothesis. It's only a hypothesis, but it's a type of little mini clairvoyance, a little dose of clairvoyance, precognition. That's really quite common among people who are spending a lot of time in retreat. Yeah, I first learned about this from Genlam Rinpoche when I was up in the mountains, and he was my nearest neighbor. Maybe, I don't know, 25 meters away from my hut, he had his hut. And I would meet with him for once a month when I went on that first long retreat under his holiness. He'd been up there, I don't know, 20 years, and there were other yogis, again, Tutopla, and other yogis, again, Asam, Chamawondu. These had been up there for 20 or 30 years, these yogis, some of them, you know, really decades. And once in a while they'd gather. It was a very loose community. There was no organization. They were just yogis. But sometimes they'd get together to have lunch or just chat and so forth. And what they found that was really quite frequent without... And I think they were doing a variety of practices, some doing state regeneration, some doing meditation on emptiness, some practicing state regeneration. And when I was there in 1992, there was one who was focusing on shamatha. So different methods. But what they found was quite commonly that they would have premonitions, but a very clear and distinct premonition. You might have heard this before because I've mentioned it in public, that very rarely somebody would come up from the village, from McLeod Gunj, and it was a long and tough hike. It was about an hour and a half hike up a steep mountain, very rugged trail. But once in a while somebody would come up from the village and they'd come to this little yogi community where I lived. And unless they had an appointment or for some reason knew that a yogi was not in strict retreat, they wouldn't try to speak with anybody. These are Tibetans. They're always Tibetans. And they're coming up only to show their devotion. And they would come up and they would leave a little packet, like a little wax paper packet of biscuits, you know, at the door of the yogi. Or maybe a 5-rupee note. Just like, thank you, carry on, and just make a little like that and then go down. Or if they knew that a yogi was in a phase where he wasn't in very strict retreat, then they knew if they came at lunchtime, that'd be okay. And then they could maybe ask questions about Dharma, their own meditative practice, or what have you. And so that happened. It was rare. I was up there for 5 months. The visa ran out, I think, once or twice. But one of these Tibetans would leave a little packet of cookies, you know, for me and with the other yogis up there. But what they found was that especially if somebody was coming up whom they knew, had some kind of connection with, that the day before this person would come up, they would have a very clear sense this person's coming up. It would appear in a dream or just some very, very strong premonition. Such and such is going to come tomorrow, you know? And it would just happen again and again. So it wasn't just chance or coincidence. They thought, this is a regularity. This is a pattern. That when I have that premonition, it tends to be true, okay? So if it's already come to mind, whether in a dream or some very strong premonition of seeing in your mind's eye, seeing that person coming up, seeing that person knock on your door, seeing that person give you some cookies or rupee note or what have you, then when it actually happens, it's a deja vu. It's a deja vu, right? And so it's possible, in your dreams, whether or not you remember the dreams, you may have some premonitions of what will happen the next day. You may then forget the dream, but then when it happens during the day, you have a sense of having already experienced it, but you can't remember when. And that would be a deja vu. Okay? So that's possible. Not so unusual. Now, it's mysterious. If what I'm saying is true and it's not just sheer, flat-out coincidence, whatever, like that, but if this is really true, that it's way beyond statistical average, you know, just to explain away, then it is very mysterious. Because when you're sleeping, dreaming, in normal case, at best you're just going to be going into the substrate consciousness, right? Your ground state of your dreams. But bearing in mind that the substrate, if we consider the rikpa is like fluid water, this is classic metaphor, rikpa is like water in its fluid state, and your coarse mind is like an ice cube, just locked into, crystallized, into grasping everything in its place and everything concretized. Oh, there's Regina over there from her own side, and I'm over here, and so forth. Everything crystallized, locked in, rigidified in the coarse mind. If we take those two as opposites, the fluid of rikpa with no grasping, coarse mind saturated by grasping, then the substrate consciousness is like slush. It's something in between. And my strong sense, my intuition is that when you're resting there in the substrate consciousness, and Atish and so many others say this is your portal to developing clairvoyance, extrasensory perception, including precognition, that you're not having precognition, you're not having actual knowledge of what's taking place in the future by tapping into your substrate consciousness. Because the substrate consciousness is a repository of your memories, but it's not a repository of the future. It hasn't happened yet, right? But because it's porous, it can be something like, I'll use a metaphor from modern physics, like a wormhole, that you're there, and little, like worms of knowledge, little rays of knowledge, of reality, may filter from the rikpa, from primordial consciousness, indivisible from absolute space of phenomena, indivisible from the fourth time, right? Just rays of reality, little islands in the oceans of possibility, of things that the conditions are already there, it's going to happen. So it can happen for even mundane stuff, that a person has made a decision to come and visit you the next day. There is nothing there that's going to prevent it. He fully plans to do it. Intention is set. So it's going to happen. Because he has all the ability to do it, and there's just nothing in the environment that's going to block that. It could. Somebody could shoot him, but there's no one to shoot him, right? In which case, you can say, okay, that's going to happen. And then from the fourth time, it already has happened. Right? Because it's not waiting for the future to happen. From the fourth time, past, present, future are coexistent. Right? So, in that regard then, is this by achieving shamatha, or by coming into greater proximity, greater awareness of the substrate consciousness, that rather porous dimension of consciousness, you may have little rays of light coming in from a deeper dimension, which gives you access to knowledge of things distant in space, which your substrate as such doesn't have any access to, because you haven't been there now, right? And also distant in time in the future. Because the rikpa is non-local, so it's just as it can just as easily access something 800 miles away as 8,000 miles away, or vice versa, and likewise for time. So there's one, I don't know him well, but I've met him a couple of times, and he came to one retreat I led years ago named Russell Targ. I've mentioned his name before, T-A-R-G. And he's the most expert man I know. He's published a number of books on precognition and remote viewing. And he's a physicist, and he got millions of dollars of grants funneled through the Stanford Research Institute. So there he was. And he and I have had some conversations about this. And from based upon his research, he said in terms of the ability to know, have a remote viewing, know things that are at a distance way beyond your sensory perception. He said when they investigated this, especially among the gifted people, he said it made no difference whether you gave them a target that was 80 feet away, but totally invisible to all of their physical senses, or 800 or 8,000 miles. It made no difference how far away it was. So it was not like the inverse square law of gravity, really good close, but then tapers off as you get further and further. That would be really good for a physical law, but this is not physical. So it didn't make any difference how far away the target was. The accuracy was the same. So it was 60%, but 80 feet or 8,000 miles doesn't make any difference. So quite interesting, I think. But that's one area, of course, that is drastically underfunded because it shouldn't happen, and therefore the people who are in control of the purse strings say it shouldn't happen, therefore it doesn't happen, and therefore we will not study it. So it's too bad. It's kind of too bad when blinkers are put on just because the evidence contradicts one's assumptions. Well, then it's not good science anymore. Okay? Yep. Okie dokie. Over to, I believe, Mick, yeah? Okay.
What's your take on the relevance of learning Tibetan nowadays? If I think about when you went to learn Dharma and so on, there wasn't almost nothing in English and so on. But nowadays, there are teachers who teach in English. There are lots of books in English. What's your take on a person who wants to practice and doesn't want to specifically become a translator and the relevance of learning Tibet?
Yeah, very good. That's a very timely question. So I won't belabor the past, because back then, if you were serious, you just had to study the language, written and spoken. Hardly any books, and hardly any lama spoke English. Basically, none of them did. Not in the 71. There were a couple of translators, and that was it. Nowadays, there are so many really good books. I mean, hundreds of really good books. There are a number of qualified Western teachers. I won't give names, because then I would exclude a whole bunch of people, but there are some very qualified Western teachers. And then quite a number, I mean, a growing number of, first of all, really good scholars, Kempos, Geshes, you know, that have really solid training, academic training. They know Buddhism very well. Whether or not they're great adepts, that is, yogis and so forth, that's another question. But I never look down on a person who's not a yogi, but has really studied Dharma well, learned it well, can teach it accurately. I think it's never something to disparage. You know, that's really worth something. And there are a number of people like that, Geshes, Kempos, Tibetans, Bhutanese, and so forth and so on. So that wasn't true a long time ago. So in terms of gaining a good conceptual understanding, you can definitely get an awful lot without learning English, without learning spoken or written Tibetan. And then there are a number of, you know, very qualified teachers who, Tibetans, for example, so let's just keep in that without going to Japan, Korea, Thailand, and so forth, just in this area. There are a number of very qualified yogis, teachers who speak, their number who speak good English, and then there's a larger number who have good interpreters, really good interpreters. And, you know, so you can't speak directly to the Lama, but the interpreter's there, and you can get time with the Lama, then there it is. You've got, you know, a really accomplished yogi who speaks through an interpreter. A young Tantra, which is still alive, and he's really an accomplished yogi. He doesn't speak any English. He's about 82 or so, I think. But he's got a good interpreter. Great, you know. So for generally speaking, if one is really focused on, I simply want to practice, to learn the teachings so I can practice them, meditate, proceed along the path, not necessary. Not necessary. At the same time, if you... So there it is. That's the full answer right there. It's not necessary. Not now. And people who have spent time in India, know that those, and again, I won't give names because I'd leave out other names, and I want to be really unbiased here, unprejudiced, not just pick some of my favorite lamas or the ones I happen to know. That's, I think it's not very fair, and I don't want to do that. But for lamas who are really, there's another issue, are they really skillful in teaching? Not every good scholar is a good teacher. Not every good yogi is a really articulate teacher. They can really give you very helpful guidance. Not necessarily, right? I think some people here would bear witness to that. So if you do find someone who speaks English or has an interpreter and has very good understanding and has realization and either speaks English or has an interpreter and is really capable, that person probably has a lot of students. A lot of students. In which case, then, and often they're really in high demand, so they're traveling all over the world. So unless you just live on jets and follow them around, you know, you'll not be able to get any sustained training from them. You know, maybe a month, really, if you're really fortunate. Oh, a month, but then the lama's gone, they're there, or there, or maybe goes into retreat or what have you. So, or even if the lama is staying mostly in one place, has a lot of students, then your chance of having a one-on-one conversation, maybe once a month, it's pretty difficult because they're popular. A lot of people want to come for a very good reason. So I would say this, is there a rationale? Is it necessary? No. Are there good reasons for even now studying the language sufficiently so that you can really sit down with a lama and get it straight from the lama in the native language? I can tell you, because I've been fluent since about 1973, it's really sweet when they can just talk free flow in their own language where nothing is translated and all of the words have all the nuance that they were intended to have, you know, and it's just like, just flowing. And then you got a text in front of you and the text is all there and the lama's speech and the text are in the same language, one classical, one colloquial. But you see this whole dance between the written and the spoken. And there you are, just taking it all in. You've got your text, and you're drinking in the text, and drinking in the Lama's teachings, and it's all fusing. And then, here's an advantage. And that is, if you've become fluent in the spoken, you can start to meditate in Tibetan. That is, you can choose the same words. You know, you can be guiding yourself in Tibetan, which means there's no questions of translation, because you get it, and you're getting it straight. You can start dreaming in Tibetan. That's interesting. But the point there is, if you can speak Tibetan, then, man, there are a lot of lamas out there who are not popular lamas. They're not known to Westerners. They don't have an interpreter, never even thought about learning English. But they're, you know, abbot of some monastery back in the remote regions of Nepal, or Sikkim, or Bhutan, or Ladakh, or Tibet itself, or other parts of India, south of India, Bangalore, and so forth. So there are quite a number of lamas that are really superb, and they just haven't engaged with Westerners. When I went into my first retreat with His Holiness, 1980, I asked him, do you know any Tibetans who've achieved shamatha? He said, yeah, and he immediately gave a name of one Gelupa Geshe, fully achieved shamatha, no question about it. I don't think he ever taught a Westerner. I don't think he ever learned, I'm sure he never learned English. He was well known, and well known that he achieved shamatha. Well, if you could at that time, I was trained for His Holiness. I wasn't looking anyplace else. But at that time, if you could speak Tibetan, you could seek him out. You know, you'd be in good shape, right? And that's just for shamatha, let alone vipassana and state regeneration and so forth and so on. And then the texts. There are a lot of really good classic texts translated into English, mostly English, and then other European languages. But in terms of what's out there, that is available, texts that are preserved, and texts that have been translated, what should we say, 1/10 of 1/10 of 1%? I mean, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction. We have a lot. But then you consider, hey, this is a 1,200-year-old tradition here, and that's not counting India. The hundreds of texts from the Sanskrit translating into Tibetan, you've got this ocean of texts that you can study that even in your lifetime, if it ever gets up to 1%, it'll be remarkable in your lifetime. Unless imagine you live a nice long one, right? So you have at your fingertips so much more information that now you can just pick up, you just go into the Tibetan library and, oh, yeah, yeah. And they just start reading away. So there you are. Suddenly, you've gone from a few lamas who can speak English, have good interpreters, and then you can wait in line to get some personal relationship with them. Or you can learn the language, and then suddenly, oh, they're a lot there, you know. And then all their library is all there. So there it is. So yes, it's not necessary. And yes, if you're skilled in language, don't find it too difficult. Still a lot of benefit in learning language. Go for it.
Does it get easier to learn the language after you achieve shamatha?
Everything's easier after shamatha, sure. And it's not a bad rationale. I mean, you know. But again, yeah, it's not a bad strategy to think about making your mind as serviceable as it possibly can be before you take on a large endeavor like learning Tibetan. Ho-ho, that's really something. Good old monsoon. But I'm just going to make this point again. If you really put your mind to, what's a better term for it, absolutely commit yourself to achieving shamatha. Say, okay, now that's it. I'm just taking this on like the Buddha under the tree. All right, I'm sitting here until I'm enlightened. If you take that on, okay, I'm just going for it now. I'm not going to look left or right. I'm going for it. Then it's a marvelous motivation, really good motivation. Just make sure you have a place to practice, because it can be so frustrating. To have from your side, have maybe all of the inner qualities there, the contentment, lower desires, few desires, all of that, and then find yourself you're just not in a conducive environment. That can ruin it. It looks so trivial compared to how hard it is to morph from a cat to an elephant and get elephant status, you know, get an elephant badge. There you are, you're a full-fledged elephant, join the club, and then find there are no pools of water, just mud. You know, then that's really tough. So, since I only have one or two more days to just say the same thing over and over again, get a conducive environment, and with really qualified teachers, teachers, students, practitioners, conducive environment, fully qualified practitioners, the sky's the limit. But if either one of those is missing, then it can just be very long drawn out. It can really take a lot of time and be very frustrating. And yet, for the students, you know, students who've been practicing, some of them in retreat for years, what I find remarkable is that even though it's tough going and a lot of challenges over the years with environment, I don't know any of them that have given up. I don't know of any. There might be some. They probably guess they wouldn't write to me. But I don't know giving up. Somehow, there's kind of that hair on fire kind of thing. Of a drive. I think what it really is they see the value. Because I'm not clever enough or glib enough to persuade people, you know, and then have it continue. I don't think anybody's that powerful, and I'm certainly not. So if they have that kind of commitment, it has to be coming from inside. So there we are. So conducive environment, there we are. Good. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're off to the right. But Cecil's hand was up first, so we'll go there first.
Thank you, Alan. This is a question with regards to awareness of awareness.
Ah, good.
So I'm quite confident that I know that I'm practicing well.
Good.
When I'm doing it.
Yeah.
However, over the course of the time here, the quality that defines certainty.
Yeah.
The awareness itself seems to be shifting slightly. So. I can give you adjectives like perhaps there's stillness or more stillness. There's more.
Yeah.
There's a thin. It's thinner. It's clearer. But none of those are the definition.
Right.
And so the question arises: are those appearances, or am I still legitimately going down the rope of awareness?
There's very good reason to believe the latter. The latter. It's an inside job, and that is to, as you're on the stage four, and until then you've dealt with coarse excitation extensively, you've probably had a lot of exposure to dullness, flat-out dullness, the mind is just not clear, right? Get up to stage four, and then having achieved stage four, then you will see certain sessions, and it's entirely internal. And you can't really say, you can't speak with Quinn or with Jerome or anybody else and say, well, I had this experience, what was yours like? And then learn anything from somebody else's description. because there's always an inside job, right? I mean, maybe a little bit, but in terms of determining coarse laxity versus medium laxity, words from other people might be helpful, but mostly you need to learn the words and then just go in and start tasting. And so there you are. If you already experienced dullness, but you're free of dullness, stage four, okay? Then within that, as you're kind of really practicing within that bandwidth of stage four, you'll have some sessions when it's really quite relatively sharp, bright, high degree of clarity. And then you'll have other sessions where you're still stable, but you'll see, this is not as clear as I've experienced it in the past. This I'm going to call coarse laxity, not dullness. Dullness is history. But this I'm going to call coarse laxity. Now, a person on stage two won't even know what you're talking about. You on stage two wouldn't know what you're talking about. Of course, coarse laxity would have been a really good session for you. Right? But now, relative to stage four, when you've gotten stage four and you've experienced what it's like to be free of coarse laxity, let alone dullness, now compared to the session you had this morning, this one at the afternoon at 2 o'clock, this isn't quite as clear as it used to be. I'm going to call that coarse laxity. Because I want it to be as good as it could be, and I've had one of those in the morning. And so I'm going to say that's free of coarse laxity, but this is, you know, filtered with coarse laxity. And so now this is where the fine-tuning starts coming, and I've got to crank it up a little bit, but don't destabilize the system, right? And then when you're up in stage six, and then stage seven, eight, and so forth, then within that same internal paradigm, that internal bandwidth, then you're recognizing, up here, this is medium. I'm going to call this medium laxity. And then you get up to stage seven and eight, okay, I'm going to call this subtle laxity, right? And likewise, the excitation's a bit easier to identify, a bit easier, and the descriptions are pretty straightforward conceptually, but the laxity is difficult. So the sheer point of it is that the bar is raised. The bar is raised as an internal, having that sense of greater clarity, greater calm, greater quiet, but you get there only by climbing the mountain and finding, from this perspective, you can see what's lower. So the higher can always see the lower, but the lower can't see the higher. That's a good rule of thumb. Okay? Is clear? Okay. Oh, yeah. A little bit more time. Anything on the left? Just because I want to try to be equal here. If there's nothing on the left, we'll go to Quinn. Going once, twice, to Quinn.
For those who would like another check state, I've...
State check, yes.
I've been using the one where you cover your mouth and your nose, and if you can still breathe, you're dreaming. Although it backfailed for me once. I was having a dream where I had some strange liquid that was glowing on my hands, and I didn't want to touch my face.
Right. So that one's good.
But I knew to take a state check. And
that's a good state check.
It's very disappointing that it wouldn't work then.
Very good, very good. And a similar one that I've heard it before. I haven't heard that one before. But one I have heard of is if you find yourself underwater, if you can breathe, you've either died and been born as a fish, or you're dreaming, one of the two. Yeah, but it's not uncommon to be able to be underwater and be able to breathe if you're dreaming.
Okay, so I have a question, but it has three parts, so you have to be quick. Good. I wonder if you can clarify some terms that you use, one of which you use quite frequently, and it's in your books as well. Reality-based.
Yeah.
And I find it troublesome if you mean a reality relative to a conceptual framework.
Yes.
Because how many of those are there?
Sure. There's a balance here. And I wrote about this extensively in a book. I think you may have read Choosing Reality. So we have instrumentalism on the one hand, or there's another term, anti-realism. Anti-realism, and that's a sophisticated philosophical system, anti-realism, among which there are various varieties. And then there's metaphysical realism, and this is what most scientists buy into, and that is that there's a real world already out there and we're trying to map it. But it's already there and we're mapping and getting a fuller and more accurate picture of what's already absolutely and objectively out there. The middle way view, that of Madhyamaka, refutes, of course, this metaphysical realism, because that would imply everything has its own inherent nature, but it also refutes the notion that, well, your conceptual framework is as good as mine. I've just dropped three tabs of LSD, and that's my conceptual framework, and there really are green kangaroos in the mind center. because that's my conceptual framework. Okay, so within Madhyamaka, it is a middle way. It's a middle way. It's not just anybody's opinion is as good as anybody else's. Anybody's conceptual framework is just as real as anybody else's. No, it's not true. So there's a whole very, very developed field of Buddhist epistemology, of ways of knowing, and it's linked very closely with logic, with debate, with very, very critical, rational thinking to determine what is pramana and what is not pramana. And pramana is valid cognition. There's valid cognition by way of perception, and that is, I know the color of your T-shirt. There's valid cognition by way of inference. There are different types of inference. So this is one of the first things we studied when I was training, getting the formal training as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. And so reality-based means, number one, no, not ultimate reality. What do we know about that, you know? No, reality-based is conventional reality. Conventional reality, which, this is an enormous topic, but there are... It's a conventional reality that is not just up for grabs by majority vote or something like that, but for which there is consensus. There's consensus within a certain population. Okay, this is too short a time because what you're going is to right to the heart of the Madhyamaka view. So
you've answered the question for me.
Okay,
at least.
Let me just add this point from William James, because I think it's very, very helpful. So I'm not going to give you the whole Madhyamaka exposition in 2 minutes. But this I think very helpful. And that is when we're trying to see, is it true or not? Is something real or is it not real? We have on the one hand, epistemological approach, that is trying to bring to it a mind that is as stable, as clear, as sharp, as intelligent as possible, and then asking, checking, probing, and see if we can come to a definitive conclusion. So that would be the epistemic way of determining true or false, real or not real. So that's very familiar. But William James, following the theme of Charles Peirce, great pragmatist, and Peirce kind of really launched it, and William James promoted it heavily. He said, "Look, there's another way of testing something, whether something's real or not, and that does it work? Does it work? And so take it as a working hypothesis." And then do something on the basis of that and see what happens, you know? And if something's real, then that's going to be, it's going to have a pragmatic kickback or some influence from it. And that's very useful. So for example, let's take shamatha. Let's take shamatha as an example. And that is, let's imagine that someone thinks, I think I've achieved shamatha. I've got this pressure on top of my head, I'm very blissful, my senses are pretty much withdrawn, and so forth. I think it's shamatha. Okay, and epistemically, I'm looking for the marks, the signs, and so forth. Can I meditate for 4 hours? Well, pretty close, or whatever. So you're looking for the signs. Okay, I think I've achieved shamatha. Good. Now, what are the pragmatic benefits of shamatha? Oh, okay. And then you see, the five obscurations have gone way down. And then you see all of this list of state effects and trait effects that have a major impact on your quality of awareness in between sessions that really transform. And then you say, okay, do you have those? And that's pragmatic, okay? That's pragmatic. So one is just looking at the experience itself. But the other one is, if you have the experience, it should have this kind of effect. Do you have those effects or not? Same thing with realization of emptiness. One may think, I think that was emptiness. It was certainly vacuous or whatever, but it seemed pretty empty. Good. If you have realization of emptiness, then this should have a major impact on your mental afflictions. If you realize rikpa, an even more major impact on your mental afflictions. It's not just so you can, rick out. But the whole idea that purifies the mind. So that's a very pragmatic issue there. Is yes, look to see whether it seems to have the characteristics of the issue in question, but also does it have the pragmatic outcome of that. So one quick one, and I think you have something more.
Next term of yours that you spoke of at length a couple Tuesdays ago, but it's come up a couple times since then.
Yeah.
Allowing reality to come up and meet you, or yes, the world to come up and meet
yes,
you.
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one phrase that I do not translate from Tibetan. I don't know how you say that in Tibetan. Let reality rise up to meet you. Because it's kind of a secular phrasing. Reality, okay, not God, not Buddha, not angels, just let reality rise up to meet you, right? I like it, because I like to tap into secular phrasing when it seems still appropriate. But where that will be couched in more in a kind of a traditional Buddhist context is offer prayers to the Buddhas, to the Gurus, to your Yidam, and blessings will flow. Blessings will flow, and that's the source of them. But then you ask, okay, but is it really somebody out there? Is it Buddha? And how far away is he? Is this a Buddha on planet Earth or on the moon, or is he at least in our solar system? Who's doing it? And that's not the answer, right? Because all of these appearances of the Buddhas, they're nothing other, from a Dzogchen perspective, they're nothing other than displays of your own pristine awareness. And so what is that pristine awareness? Well, that's indivisible from the absolute space of phenomena, and that's ultimate reality. So it's reality from the ultimate dimension up, rising up to meet you. And if you put it in a devotional context, which I'm very happy with, then this is the blessings of the Guru, of the Buddhas, of the Yidam, and so forth. So that would be placing that in more traditional context.
I can't visualize it in really simplistic terms.
And that is, it's one finds frequently in the devotional literature, like Tathāgata and so forth, the blessings may be there even for hedonic stuff. Not just, no, hedonic is just karma. We only help you, so wrong question. We help you only with, you know, spiritual questions. Interestingly enough, there are many cases where a prayer comes for something more hedonic, meaningful, but hedonic. And people reporting, yeah, the blessings really flowed. If that's the case, then all the more so for something that is really purely in Dharma. Now go ahead, final one.
Well, with this one, when you say reality rises up to meet you, I imagine I'm giving it a high five or something, like something's coming up.
Reality is happening. But reality is happening in accordance with to fulfill your deepest aspirations. So I'm sure I probably even told in this retreat, my being out there on the road between Bergen and Oslo and writing in my journal, I've got to meet a wise old man. I really need some guidance now. You know the story, don't you? Okay, final story. For the one person in the room who has not heard this story, and I'm teasing, probably somebody else. But I was 20. I was 20, and I'd picked up this one book on Tibetan Buddhism, the first one I'd ever read, left behind at a youth hostel in Switzerland. Somebody left it behind. I said, okay, I'll pick it up. Let's see what's in there. And it just captivated me. I couldn't hardly understand anything, because it's Dzogchen, and, you know, there were hardly any good books back there anyway, but there was just something about it, like, this is it. And so I was reading that and just feeling, this is really it, and hitchhiking up through Europe from Switzerland way up to Norway, way out to Bergen, out to the West Coast, and then I'm hitchhiking back from Bergen. My roommate from college, he took off to Scotland for his junior year, and finally, for the first time, I'm on my own. And My buddy took off on the ferry going from Bergen over to Newcastle or something on the east coast of Scotland. And for the first time in the whole 2 months of hitchhiking around Europe, I'm on my own. And I write in my journal either that morning or the night before, because I'm just blazing here, like hairs on fire. I've got to get some guidance here. A book isn't enough. And I wrote in my journal, I've got to find a wise old man. Couldn't be a young, beautiful, wise woman. No way, no, that wouldn't work at all. Or a young wise man, they don't exist, we know that. So, almost. But the archetype, and we're dealing with archetypes here. I needed a wise old man. I need a wise old man. So there I am, so I get my great big kilty backpack, I had a guitar, of course, and I'm hitchhiking out of Bergen, and it's real slow going, hardly anybody's picking me up, and somebody drops me off in the middle of the wilderness between Bergen and Oslo, and there's not much in between. Right? A few little towns, and it's it. What is it? Maybe 200 miles, 350 kilometers, something like that? It's pretty close, yeah? It's a lot of forests and a lot of wilderness, and I'm just plunked down on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere, and I'm waiting with my thumb out, you know, give me a ride. Nobody picks me up. 4 hours goes by, and like every other American hippie, I had traveler's checks in my back pocket. So I'm going against the grain of, I give up. I said, I'm getting out of this area. People don't want to pick up hitchhikers. And so I was walking against the grain of the traffic to the nearest train station to just get out of there, try to get 100 kilometers ahead and pick up a ride someplace else. So I'm walking against the grain of the traffic, but dangling my thumb out, because it doesn't cost anything. And then strangely enough, this little black VW bug, Volkswagen, pulls over to the side. And there's a little guy there, and he looks at me like that. And I really didn't know what he was asking, what it was doing, because I would kind of lost connection with my thumb. And then it occurred to me, oh yes, I was hitchhiking, and I think he's giving me a ride. And so I said, oh, good. So I ran over there and filled the whole back seat of his VW with my big backpack and my big guitar, a big acoustic guitar I bought in Germany. And so if my roommate had been with me, because he was a big guy also, and also had a big backpack, and also had a guitar. We didn't have no ride. There was not enough room for three guys and baggage. But I filled the back seat with that, got into the passenger seat, and he drove me off about 5 or 10 minutes, which is like, that was worse than a train ride. That was nothing. That was like, you may as well go around in circles. In 5 or 10 minutes, I learned he was a Buddhist monk who lived in Nepal with Tibetans. At that time, there might have been 2 or 3 Buddhist monks in all of Europe. And he picked me up on the side of the road. And in 5 minutes, I learned that. In 5 minutes, he learned that I was really interested in Buddhism. And we found after 5 or 10 minutes, because he was taking a left to go up into the mountains. He had a little chalet there. And he made his living painting bowls, folk art in Norway, wooden bowls, and then painting them. And he was a very, very gifted artist. So he lived up in a little chalet up in the mountains, way above the road, and he was heading home. But we just connected so quickly, and such a heartfelt connection. He said, oh, let's have some ice cream. And I'm always up for an ice cream. And so we stopped, and then we had ice cream. We talked at a leisure pace. I got to know more about him. Fascinating life. I won't give the whole story now. He learned more about me. Not much fascinating there at all. He was interested in Buddhism. And then he gave me some quintessential advice, very simple, but quintessential, just what I needed to hear. And then he dropped me off. I got a ride out of there. And reality rose up to meet me. I mean, I needed a wise old man, and that he was a wise old man. He would spend the winters touring all over Europe giving lectures on India and on Buddhism. And in summers, he'd stay up in Norway painting his bowls. So he moved back and forth. And so that just struck me at the age of 20. This is too wild to be a coincidence. That's just too much. How many, 200-300 million Europeans at that time? And I got picked up by a Buddhist monk who'd lived with Tibetans in Nepal. I thought, that's too much. There's something going on. Something's afoot. Something's fishy. This is not the great mechanical, mindless universe that I was told we live in. And then I got down to Göttingen, and I could keep you really and really wipe out your whole dinner. But I'll just tell you this fast, even though 40 years has passed, but got down to Göttingen, where I was going to spend my junior year. I was planning to study philosophy and ecology, only to find they had nothing on ecology, and the philosophy was dry, really, really dry. At least to me it was dry. I had no interest. But I'd only been there in Göttingen for a few days, and I learned that they had an Indology department, a whole department for the study of Indian culture, and that there was a Tibetan Lama who had just been appointed, been invited there and sent by the Dalai Lama, and he was there, and he had no students. And so I met him, and it just blissful, like, whoa, right on time. The Dalai Lama sent me here, and I became his only student. And he taught me Tibetan for the rest of the year. But I remember meeting him and just skipping like a 10-year-old, skipping down, because he lived up on the kind of a gentle hill, skipping down the road, just feeling, yes. And I wound up dropping all my other courses and just studying Tibetan. And then I could go on, but just one thing after another. For me, then, this is no longer an article of faith. I don't have faith in gravity. I don't have faith that rain falls down and not up. You see it enough. Pretty much there's a pattern there. I just, in my life, it's just following a pattern. And it's not like a movie star, like a Gwyneth Paltrow saying, oh, you know, if you really believe in yourself, you'll succeed. And try really hard, and you too can realize your dreams. I didn't bring anything exceptional at all, really. I mean, bright kid, I could learn language. But man, there are millions of bright kids like I was. I mean, just millions, a dime a dozen. So there's nothing special at all. But my sincerity was there. The motivation was there. That I would claim. My motivation was really very sincere. And it kept on. And I just found opportunity arising after opportunity after opportunity. Really weird. Happy weird. That something's going on here. And these are things over which I have no control. I didn't control that man picking me up on the side of the road. I didn't control this lama being appointed there just, I think it was months before I arrived. And then one thing after another, no control, not even dream of control, but reality rising up to meet and take me a step further and further and further. So that's made quite an impression on me. And it's a very clear, and I've seen this with other people as well, and not superstars. I'm no superstar. I'm pretty ordinary, written a lot of books that very few people read. Woohoo! All of the 40 books I published, I think all together they might make one pretty decent selling book. So nothing special. But know a lot of Dharma practitioners. And when the sincerity is there, reality rises up to me. That's been my experience. Okay? Oh, Lasso, kept you over 10 minutes late. You're welcome. Good? Mangiare. Let's hear a lot of chatter in there.